The following is a presentation of the Matt Talk Podcast Network.
Welcome to On the Mat. I am Kyle Klingman of the National Wrestling Hall of Fame Dan Gable Museum, joined by the wild card, Andy Hamilton of TrackWrestling.com. You've got to be beaming right now after the Yankees win a one-game playoff, a sport that values a large pool of data. 162 games comes down to one game. I don't get it. But either way, the Yankees are in to play the Boston Red Sox.
The real playoffs begin now.
Yeah.
Friday night.
Do you like this wild card real quick? What do you think?
I mean, I watched these last two games, and I've been glued to the Yankees all 160. Well, I don't want to say all 162 games, but I've watched probably, 125 or 130 of them this year, I bet. And for them to win 100 games and then it all comes down to one, I mean, that's a pretty tough pill to swallow if you lose that game.
I know.
Look at the Cubs. They won 95 games more. They tied for the most wins in the National League, and they're done.
Yeah.
So 2015, the Yankees lost in that wild card game, and it was like, you got to be kidding me. They played 6 months to have it all crumble in 3 hours.
But
that being said, I mean, you look at what the second wild card has done, and it's created tremendous drama for the last several weeks of the season now. I mean, so many more teams are in it because, like, if there's only one wild card, now this isn't a good example this year, but because the Yankees and A's, it was pretty apparent going into about the final 3 weeks of the season. It was just those two teams. It wasn't like the Rays were going to catch them and Seattle had fallen out of the race. But, yeah, it is just, it's kept so many more teams in it, created so much more drama down the stretch in so many cities around the country. So I think that's been good. Would a best of three make it better? I don't know. I mean, if your team loses in the wild card, yeah, you want a best of three.
Yeah,
but,
of course.
I don't think we get the same kind of drama that we saw the other day with the Cubs and Rockies if all the chips aren't in the center of the table.
You have an interesting scenario. If the Yankees are still in the playoffs when we're at the World Championships, it's already going to be insanely busy for you. What are you going to do if the Yankees are playing in the middle of the night?
I don't know.
I just don't know how that's going to play out. So you want them to lose, right? Because of that?
No way. No way. Absolutely not. I'll deal with it. I'll find a way.
You'll find a way to...
I was thinking about this last night. We leave on October 16th, mm-hmm. Tuesday night, and that would be game three, maybe, of the American League Championship Series or something like that.
If they get there. Yep.
So thinking about how in the world I'm going to watch that game on a flight from Chicago to Zurich, that's going to be quite an intriguing dilemma for me. I don't know if I'm going to be able to pull that off, if we'll get a good enough Wi-Fi signal on the plane.
Yeah. Well, we know that you like country music. I have to know you. I'm assuming you like games. So I'm going to ask if you'd like to play a game called What Might Have Been, a spinoff of the Little Texas Song, if you remember that far back.
I do.
What I'd like to do is ask what might have been if Henry Cejudo and Aaron Pico would have actually wrestled the collegiate season. Because it is interesting to think about Henry Cejudo, who took a unique route, went into the Olympic Games in 2008 at the age of, 21? He won the Olympics. And then Aaron Pico was even younger. He made the final Olympic trials at the age of 19. I'm just making these up. High school senior. What do you think they would have done had they had 4 years of eligibility and gone through the college system? Do you think? Well, we'll start with Henry Cejudo. Do you think he would have been an undefeated four-time NCAA wrestling champion had he taken that route? And that includes schooling and having to stay eligible and all of those things that go into it. What would that have looked like had Henry Cejudo taken the college route?
I don't know. I don't think he would have gone undefeated for 4 years. I don't think so.
I don't either, by the way. I just think that it's such a different scenario. I think someone could have maybe ridden him. I don't know if that would have been the scenario with Henry Cejudo. And of course, Henry Cejudo, 2008 Olympic gold medalist, phenomenal story, was the youngest Olympic wrestling champion until Kyle Snyder broke that record, youngest Olympic wrestling champion from the United States. We have to qualify that.
So you're saying, I don't know. Are you saying that he goes from what he was out at the training center, I think at what, 16, 17 years old?
Yeah.
If he goes at 18 years old to University of fill in the blank.
Right. What would that have looked like?
I don't know. I think a lot depends on fit, where he goes, what the training partners are like, what his environment is like from a social and academic standpoint. I mean, there's just so much more to it that can derail you in college. And that be interesting to, you know, even to a certain degree, get Thomas Gilman's take on being a professional now, where you're not having to deal with academics and stuff like that. Your sole focus is on wrestling, and then you figure out what to do with your idle time when you're not training. But a lot of things can get in your way when you're 18, 19, 20 years old and off on your own for the first time in your life.
But it is an interesting scenario to look at what those two athletes had done, not going the traditional collegiate route, just went into the Olympic movement and then went into mixed martial arts. Aaron Pico's was extremely different in that he did his thing at the 2016 Olympic trials, then he got out. I would have loved to have seen what he could have done in a college wrestling program, but maybe it wasn't the fit for him. You do have that grind of 30 to 40 matches, and what does that look like for a guy like that? That's a big commitment, and maybe he wanted to get to the professional level faster than what other people did, and clearly he took that route.
Yeah, I mean, we only get to see him wrestle, what, 1 year of high school wrestling, too?
It's crazy. That's just crazy. Yeah. I feel like we lost two of our greatest competitors to just timing and wanting to get out. And I understand with Henry Cejudo, he had an opportunity to make more money, won the Olympic Games. It's a great story. You have to capitalize on those 4 years, made that comeback and 2016, but it's pretty remarkable to think about what that could have looked like had there been 4 years of college. And we've had Sam Hayswinkle on the program. I think Sam Hayswinkle would have had some of that crossover with Henry Cejudo. What would those matches have looked like? Would a Coleman Scott against Henry Cejudo, could he have made 125 the whole time, or would he had gone to 133? A lot of different scenarios in how those guys could have played out.
Yeah, and you never know, too, like with... Once a guy reaches the top of the mountain, how bad do they want to stay on top of the mountain? How bad do they want to maintain that level of commitment that it takes to be on top? Because it's different. You went at one time and you're the targeted guy now. You're the guy that everybody's coming after. And that's what's been so remarkable about the longevity of Jordan Burroughs and what we're seeing with Kyle Snyder so far. Is they've been able to back it up and win titles in back-to-back years and multiple, you know, string together multiple gold medals at the world and Olympic level.
And even at the NCAA championships, too, that's, you always hear that. John Smith's the advocate of that. You do it once, but let's see you try to do it again. You have a 4-year window, of course, to make that happen, to win multiple championships. That is Herculean, especially with that small time frame. And so I just feel like with Aaron Pico, I just feel like we may have lost one of our great stars. We just don't talk about him anymore. He's just fallen out of relevance within wrestling because...
I mean, people are still paying attention to him.
To mixed martial arts.
Yeah. But he said, like, I could come back and make the Olympic team. Does he make a run in 2020?
Gosh. And do you see that happening? Because you just talked about the commitment level. 4-year gap, that's a big window. We saw Cejudo try it, and it doesn't really work because you're not in it. And mixed martial arts training is different than wrestling training and vice versa. Yeah. It just doesn't cross over the same way. You can be right there. You could be third through fifth on the ladder. But to get to that top level at the Olympic trials, what do you think? Do you think he's going to make that run in 2020? Do you think
I don't know. There's so many unknowns about it. Like what drives a guy?
Yeah.
You know, is becoming the best fighter in the world more important to him than becoming the best wrestler? Like, what would mean more to him? a belt or an Olympic gold medal.
Yeah.
I don't know.
If he gets the Olympic gold medal and then he goes into mixed martial arts, he's way more marketable, though. I think that does add quite a bit, because having Henry Cejudo have that gold medal, that makes him more marketable in mixed martial arts. And I think that's a neat component to be able to have that credential attached to it. And
you're talking about like popularity too. And would these guys be bigger names if they had gone the 4-year route?
Yeah.
I think there's something to be said for that. Like, look at how many people are in the stands at the NCAA championships. You get 20,000 people there every session in Cleveland. How many people are watching around the country on live television and paying attention to what's going on in that tournament? And yet, we've talked about it before. There's just that disconnect. Once you take off the college singlet and you're competing for yourself or your club, we just struggled to gain that kind of following at the international level. And we've talked about it before on the show. Like, it's just really hard to wrap your head around the fact that you go higher on the ladder in wrestling and the following gets smaller.
Yeah.
Be like, you know, we're recording this a few blocks down from the Uni Dome, and it would be like the state championships in Iowa high school football drawing 3 or 4 times more than the Super Bowl.
Super Bowl, yeah. Yeah, that's
when you think about it. Yeah. Like the World Cup drew like 6,700 people, something like that, in Iowa City. The Iowa State High School Championships put 16,000 plus in the stands for what, coming up on 30 straight years of sellouts for the state finals.
Yeah. Or even just a straight dual meet at Iowa.
Yeah.
Or even other programs that get great crowds. There is that attachment, because when you think of Kale Sanderson, you think of Iowa State, you think of Penn State. You just have that automatic connection. Kyle Snyder, Ohio State. Jordan Burroughs, Nebraska. You just attach them to those programs. And when you go to their arenas, you see those big monster posters and banners of those guys, and there's just that immediate connection. So I think the college game really does give you an additional set of star power. And those two guys that we're talking about, and Aaron Pico and Henry Cejudo, they're unique in that. Yeah. I don't know anyone else that has really gone that route and has been successful, but Aaron Pico is an exciting guy. I'd love to see him 2020, just thinking about that. I hadn't heard that he's considering that, or I think maybe I'd heard that quote, but I didn't take it serious. Boy, that'd be a lot of fun to see him back in the mix and see what he can do.
Absolutely. Think about his first match at the Olympic Trials in 2016. He's down 9-0 against Jason Ness, and then he scores 20 straight.
It was unreal. Yeah. It was the match that everyone was buzzing about, that he was that close to a tech fall or getting tech fall, and then comes back and gets a tech fall of his own, and then wins one match in the final Olympic trials and just a hair away from making the team, and then he goes into mixed martial arts. Hey, we can talk about all these stars, and we're going to continue to talk stars that are going to the 2018 World Championships. On this program, we have Thomas Gilman, Sarah Hildebrandt. They're going to be at the World Championships. I thought it was fun last week talking to a couple world teamers, but we get a chance to get Thomas Gilman on the show, Sarah Hildebrandt on the show. You've known Thomas Gilman. You've interviewed him hundreds of times. Your recollections of what he brings to the table, not only as a personality, but as a competitor. We saw that great silver medal run where he came through the World Team Trials, last chance qualifier, makes the world team. Of course, nobody's going to be satisfied with a silver, but I don't care. That's an impressive run. He did a great job.
Yeah, and you look at it, and he lost, what, 6-0 in the finals to Yuki Takahashi of Japan. But Gilman, 4 of those points, I think, were maybe all 6 were off Gilman shots. And it wasn't like he got outclassed in the finals. He got just beaten a couple positions there where he ratchets a couple things down with his single leg finishes, and he's a world champion. And I think when you look at Thomas Gilman right now and his ability to get to legs, is he's right there with some of the best guys in the world with his ability to get to the legs. He doesn't get turned, and it's hard to get to his legs. You add all 3 of those components together, and you get a guy that's capable of winning a world title this year.
And you saw that against Dayton Fix. When Fix got in, he was impossible to score on. Just his takedown defense is really good. And so because of that, you mentioned the finals match. To beat Thomas Gilman, you have to finish your shots immediately. You can't hang on because he's going to get out.
Yeah, and fix gut wrench, about as good as there is, right? And lock that thing up, and he couldn't turn Gilman either. So, yeah. So you're looking, like I said, at a guy that's pretty strong in three areas there, and I think that he's going to be right in the mix again this year to win world title.
Sara Hildebrandt is a rising star. You've had a chance to talk to her numerous times this year. What do you remember about just those conversations and what she brings?
Yeah, fun personality, outgoing, just upbeat. And you look at her story this year is really remarkable in that when I had a chance to visit with her out in Fresno at Women's Freestyle Training Camp, we talked about, like, how do you go from where she was a year ago, where she loses in the finals of the World Team Trials, actually dislocated her elbow against Becca Leathers early in the first match. So that knocks her out of the series. Leathers goes on and wins a world bronze. And Sara has a lot of time to basically just analyze where she is in her career and reflect on what she's done to this point and where she wants to go, and decided to make a lot of life changes. Gave up alcohol, cut out a lot of the sugar in her diet, changed a lot of the things that she was consuming, even looked at the people she was surrounding herself with, the influences around her. And a year ago, she told me that she was struggling, like a lot of her problems are weight management related. And she's at 55 kilos and having a hard time making 55 kilos last year. Now she's making 53 with ease.
Hmm.
So she's right there. She's going to go into Budapest as a number one seed at 53 kilos. She's lost, I think, like 3 or 4 matches this year, all close matches, and wrestled some of the best women in the world. Had a 7-6 match at the World Cup with reigning world champion Haruna Okuno of Japan. And she's also had a couple close matches here at the Poland Open with top competitors. So I think she also will be in the mix over in Budapest. I think she has a pretty good chance to win her first world medal. You never know, though. I mean, yeah. If you look at the one thing, you look at international wrestling and how unpredictable it is. I mean, look at junior world championships. Outside of Okuno, who wins a senior world title last year and a U23 world title, and now goes back to conquer the junior level after winning those two tournaments, there probably wasn't a bigger favorite to medal than Gable Steveson.
Yeah.
And gets locked up upper body in a, you know, kind of a 50-50 position and goes for it and gets put on his back and pinned. And then the guy that beat him gets knocked out in the next round. And so Gable's tournament is over. So there's a little bit of unpredictability, that element in international wrestling. So but with that said, I think that our two guests today are going to be strong medal contenders in Budapest. And Gilman already has done it, but looking to climb one step higher on the podium, and I think he's got as good of opportunity as anybody at 57 kilos.
And as we talk about star power, just with the women's wrestling movement, there's just so many great stories within women's wrestling. How many of those do you identify with their college? Probably not many. Every time we do these interviews, I have to look up where they went, and I don't really remember where Helen Maroulis went right off the top of my head.
You went
Simon Fraser. Okay. So I didn't even identify her with that. Just even more important to get Division I wrestling for women. I just think it really enhances what they can do and make women's wrestling, they can be stars. And I think really the college movement helps them become stars and just more reason for us to get NCAA sanctioned women's wrestling.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a good point. It's something I hadn't really thought about all that much, but you're spot on there.
How about a little PDI, point differential index?
Let's do it.
Getting through this, man. 184.
You wrote about it this week, Kyle.
Well, I'd written about it, for Wynn, and I thought I'd post it on Facebook. And just to explain what we're trying to accomplish here, and I just think the more we talk about it, the more you write it out, the more it makes sense. This is just a quality statistic that I think should be in every program. You have their win-loss record, and then you have PDI right next to it. And it just gives fans a way to understand their domination or where they've been throughout the course of a season.
Let's dig in.
Yeah, and there's one guy that after 9 matches, we'll start with him. was actually at a negative two after 9 matches, and he was an All-American.
Chip Ness.
Yeah. Did that surprise you a little bit? Did you? I didn't see it coming.
That he would be minus two after
minus two after 9 matches?
Well, when I looked at it, I'm like, yeah, this isn't a real good start for an All-American, but he managed to get on track in March and nice tournament in Cleveland and found his way on the podium.
Got 7th place with a 3.3. The funny comment, and I chuckled when we went through Bo Nickel, who won it, of course, at 184 pounds. When I said the final number, I said 14.5, and you said, oh, I thought it'd be a little bit higher. A little bit higher than 14.5? He's almost averaging a tech ball.
Yeah, but...
I mean, boy, come on, give him some slack.
He went
here,
undefeated,
dude.
A ton of pins. Like, think about his stretch. Let me pull it up here. I mean, this doesn't do anything to increase his point differential index, but let me pull up Bo Nickel and just give you a sampling of some of his times on falls.
Oh, that's, yeah.
26 seconds, 38 seconds, 48 seconds, 53 seconds, 42 seconds, a minute 34, a minute 9, 56, 202, 155, 323, 531. So there's, out of all the pins I've listed so far, there's only two that have been outside the first period. 50 seconds, 11 seconds, a minute 25, and 2 minutes and 30 seconds. So Bo Nickel had, 17 falls, 15 of them came in the first period last year.
Man.
So my thinking was, I guess my picture of his dominance got a little bit distorted by the fact that all these first period falls, sub-minute falls.
Yeah.
But that doesn't do anything to increase your point differential index. It just kind of looks cool on paper.
it's just puts you in awe that he was able to do that. So Bo Nickel, who is going to go up to 197 pounds this season, ended with a 14.5 last season. Miles Martin, your runner-up, had a couple losses on the season, 3 losses on the season, and his final loss was a pin, and he still had a 10.6.
And we did the numbers here. Bo Nickel cost Miles Martin 2.1 points on his average. His average is 10.6. It would have been 12.7 without those 3 losses to Bo Nickel. He had a major decision loss. He had a loss in the Big Ten finals. And then he also had that loss by fall in the NCAA finals.
Yeah. Did you see that number even with the falls and the losses? Did you see the 10.6 coming? I didn't. I didn't know he had that.
A lot of text.
Yeah, he was good, but I didn't see that number being that high. Third place, Emery Parker from Illinois, had a 5.7, probably about where I thought it'd be. I don't know what you thought.
Yeah, he had, how many losses did he have throughout the season? Lost first round of the NCAA championships and then got on a roll on the backside and made it all the way back to third place. So, yeah, I thought after the first two that the numbers, like there were some weight classes in there where we had 3 or 4 numbers that were pretty high. The 184 would fall off substantially after the first two, and it did. I mean, you're looking next in line, Taylor Venn's 7.9, which surprised me that he was the number 3 guy at 184 with 7 losses there. But
yeah,
but when he won, a lot of times he won big.
Dominic Albinader was in 5th place, 6.8, and then close behind him, Zach Zavatsky, 6.5, and then as we mentioned, Chip Ness, 3.3, and then it ends, Max Dean, 6 points even in 8th place. As we look at this, a little bit down from other weight classes, but about what you'd expect from 184 pounds with Bo Nickel leading the charge.
Well, and then, too, I think a couple of guys who are ranked pretty highly throughout the season that weren't on the podium in Cleveland, Pete Renda and Ryan Preisch, that maybe distorts the picture a little bit. And those were the guys that had very few losses throughout the regular season. And then, you know, they're not there in the end, so we're not figuring them up. So that changes the picture a little bit.
And Drew Foster was a returning All-American, and he didn't place this year. So a couple guys that could have been in the mix, but it was pretty solid weight class top to bottom. But as we move into the final two weight classes, I think heavyweight is going to be probably the most intriguing to see what the final numbers are, especially with Kyle Snyder being at the top, and then you have some good 1-2 punch, but to see how those guys taper off at 7th, 8th place to see what those numbers look like. I never thought I'd be so excited to see what heavyweight was going to end with.
We might have to knock out two of these next week.
Get out of the way before we
get over to Budapest.
Yeah.
Clear the deck.
Just do that. And then maybe when we get back, I think you had suggested this, we just have to get the full data and then maybe just do an average of the All-Americans and see what the highest rated weight class was.
How about some teams maybe?
Yeah, do some teams across the board. We have lots of options. I think this could be some compelling data. But the more we dig into it, the more I like it. I'm not losing steam on doing this. Every time it's riveting to see where these numbers fall. And I like the surprise of it. Just like with this, Miles Martin just surprised the heck out of me. I just didn't know he had that much domination throughout the season. And for him to have that high of a number, even with three losses, one of them being the fall in the finals, having a 10.61, solid number, Andy. How about we talk to Thomas Gilman?
Let's talk to Thomas Gilman.
Our first guest today, three-time All-American for the University of Iowa. He earned a silver medal at the 2017 World Championships at 57 kilograms, also known as 125.5 pounds, represents the United States again this year at the same weight class. Thomas Gilman, how are you?
I'm doing good, thanks.
Great to have you on the show. Hey, Dan Dennis, when he was talking about you, I saw a video where he said you're kind of a hippie. I don't see that in you. Do you describe yourself as a hippie?
Well, coming from Dan Dennis, it's kind of funny, but I don't know, maybe a little bit. You know, I mean, like today I rode my bike into Carver here, and I'm always riding my bike, and I'm big into, you know, the coffee scene, craft coffee and stuff. And I don't know. I mean, I don't know if I call myself a hippie, but I mean, a lot of guys on the team, and obviously Dan Dennis does. So I guess I'm a hippie. I'll embrace it.
Okay. You got Birkenstocks, so I think that's the first criteria, isn't it?
Yeah. I got my Birkenstocks. Yeah. Not wearing them today, but definitely my go-to shoe.
What do you like to do in Iowa City? What are the outlets for you?
Other than spending the most time here in Carver, I like to go downtown and grab a coffee. There's a place down there, about 2 years old, called Cortado. Take some of the college guys down there once in a while. Just hang out, grab a coffee, you know, talk. I read a lot. That's kind of my main outlet. Everything from military history to philosophy to what I call self-help books. Right. I'm a new homeowner, so now I'm just breaking stuff and putting back together pretty much. My girlfriend's not too happy about it, but I tore up half the backyard, putting in a little patio. So keep myself busy doing stuff like that.
What's the last good book you've read?
I just finished one. It's called The 12 Rules for Life by Jordan B. Peterson. It's a great book. Highly recommend it.
You seem pretty in tune with just excellence and just getting yourself to compete at a high level. How are you able to get there mentally and just make sure you maintain the discipline it takes to be successful in a really demanding sport such as wrestling?
I think for me, it comes down to just learning every day, waking up with a purpose, and humbling myself every single day too. Being humble enough to be humbled, one, and humble enough to learn. Not only from my teammates, my coaches, but also from my enemies and my opponents too. I learn a lot from my losses, and I go back and, you know, watch those losses and watch my opponents and see what I can learn from them tactically and technically too, but also how to beat them that way. But just waking up with a purpose every single day and coming into workout, not just punching the clock. You know, a lot of guys, they put in a lot of time, but it's just punching the clock. I try to come in every single day with a clear purpose and a clear goal.
Thomas, I go back to the first time I interviewed you like 7 years ago. And when I was at the register, we sent like a photographer over there to Council Bluffs. And did a story on your extensive study of international wrestling at that point. I imagine you're probably still the fanatic you were back then, maybe even more so. Who are some of the guys that you, like when you take the competitor hat off and you look around the world, who are some of the guys that you just enjoy watching now?
The guy that fascinates me the most is Haji Aliyev from Azerbaijan. He was at my weight, 57 kilos for the Olympics, but has since moved up to 61 and now 65. So it's kind of easier for me to maybe admire him a little bit more, but, he's really technically savvy and he's a great competitor. He's got a phenomenal single leg. If anyone has a better single leg in the world than me, then it's arguably him. So I like to just watch him, how he finishes and how he holds his composure. I remember watching a match from the Europeans this year. In the finals, he was losing to the Russian. I want to say like 8-2 or something pretty significant with about 40 something seconds left. And he just methodically came back and just picked this guy apart. And foreigners, you know, especially Russian, Soviet bloc countries, they're really not known for their conditioning or their grit, you know, when it comes down to it at the end of the match like that. He kind of put it, you know, kind of proved that wrong. He showed how great of a competitor he was to come back, and that's just really inspiring for me to see a guy that's that good of a competitor, but also very technically sound and savvy.
Who do you admire within the Iowa wrestling program, coach or athlete?
Oh man, there's a lot of guys. I think I admire everyone for different reasons, but. Obviously, firstly, my coach is Tom and Terry Brands. You know, I'm trying to do what they've done and kind of keep on that path that they've kind of blazed for me and before them, Gable. Just really look up to them in the sense of their mindset, mentality, not just in the wrestling room and on the mat, but also in life. You know, they're phenomenal husbands and fathers. So I that's something that I really love up to, you know, they're well-rounded human beings. Maybe down on the level of athletes, a guy that, you know, is pretty new around here, but has made a lot of noise is Spencer Lee. You know, he's a very, very technically savvy guy and a guy that you can always learn from. You know, talking about being humble, I said trials, you know, you want to be humble, you want to know where you're at, you know, grab a guy like Spencer Lee, you better be ready to go. So those are just the people that come to the top of my head.
Talking about Tom and Terry Brands, this is the 25 year anniversary of those guys winning world championships. They won it in 1993 at Toronto. As you look back, I'm assuming you've watched their world championship matches. One that stands out for me is 95 Worlds, where Terry was down 3-0 and disqualified the Canadian. When you watch that, when you experience guys like that, that have that in them, how do you take that and how do you apply that to your wrestling?
It's pretty easy philosophy wise, but it's hard to do. Right. So, I'm watching that match as I'm talking about it. So I'm a little bit behind in my speech here, but,
so you
man,
have
it,
seen
it's just
it.
A good example. It's just an example, you see it, you've seen it and I've even felt it. You know, wrestling with Terry and then just mimicking it, trying to mimic it every single day, you know, trying to just push your opponent around the mat and scoring points and just dominating.
Going into the 2018 World Championships, last year was just this incredible run where you went to the last chance qualifier after the NCAA Championships, then just went through the world team trials and then won the best out of three with Tony Ramos. As you look back at that, you have to at least admire that you had to go through such a gauntlet and you came out of it and made your first world team.
I don't know how much I look back and admire it. I just kind of look back and just kind of, you know, tell people what else was I supposed to do? You know, I was put in a tough situation, I guess. And I had no choice. I wanted to be a world champion. I want to be an Olympic champion. There wasn't anything that was going to stop me. Obviously, Takahashi from Japan stopped me, but I there was a mission and I just moved forward, just diligently. I really didn't think about it too much. And I don't think about it too much now because there's too much ahead of me that I need to be focused on. But I mean, people always say it was a great thing to watch and do. But, for me, I don't really get caught up in that. I just got to keep my eyes forward and focus on what's next.
Last year, first year as a professional, first year out of college, different type of dynamic in terms of scheduling and training, maybe, and lifestyle, I imagine, too, just with day-to-day life. What did you appreciate most about your first year out of college, and what were some of the things that took getting accustomed to?
I just appreciated just being able to wrestle and not have to go to school. As bad as that sounds, maybe, those kids listening, you got to go to school, you got to do it right. But I really enjoyed just being able to focus on my wrestling and not have to worry about, you know, allotting so much time to class and study and going to, study hall and whatnot. I just really enjoyed just coming in the morning and the afternoon, at night, whenever I wanted. You know, my day was filled with just wrestling, and that was it. So I really appreciated that. The thing I had to get used to was I had a lot of free time. You know, instead of going to class, I had to fill up my free time. I like to think that I'm still a student, not only of the sport of wrestling, but a student of life. I like to read and just increase my knowledge and everything and just try to become a better person, a better member of our society. So I kind of fill my time, my void with just learning about the sport and also life, which goes hand in hand. It's one and the same thing.
How have you seen the Hawkeye Wrestling Club transform, especially with the hiring of Mark Perry? How have you seen it change over the course of your time at Iowa?
Oh man, there's a lot I can say, but just specifically talking about Mark Perry, I mean, he's great. He brings a different kind of view and dynamic to the room. He's a Hawk. He's been here, he's left, but you know, whatever, but he's a Hawk. He's always been a Hawk at heart. So it's good to have him back. And I know he's glad to be back. He breaks down film, he breaks down opponents. You know, I don't know if that guy ever sleeps. You know, I've roomed with him a couple of times and, you know, wake up, you know, 3 o'clock in the morning, he's watching film, you know? So, I mean, he's so dedicated and, you know, we're all grateful for that, you know, breaking down opponents, what we need to do. But with, as far as other aspects of the Hawkeye Wrestling Club, I think, we're doing good things. I think the Hawkeye Wrestling Club has become less selfish. We try to put ourselves out there and help these team guys as much as possible. When I say team guys, like, University of Iowa, and the more we can help them, the more we help ourselves, right? The better we can make them, the more we bring them along, the more they'll push us, the more we'll push them, the better we all get. So that's kind of something that, is inspiring, that's kind of changed over the years.
Thomas, one of the things, you know, when you bring up Mark Perry, one of the things that he has talked about to me a lot is how coachable you are. And I hear it in this interview. You talk about learning from Spencer Lee, learning from everybody around you. How did you become coachable?
It's a good question. I think that I wasn't always this coachable. I can tell you that. I'm still a pretty hard-headed individual and, have the urge to roll my eyes at times, but I think it's just the older I get and the more I grow as a person and in my faith, I become more humble and I realize that I can learn from every single individual, whether it's, you know, my coaches or my teammates or just, you know, a random person I run into at the coffee shop. You know, someone has something to teach me. And I think that everybody was put in my life for a reason, you know, even if they're random coincidences or acquaintances. So just having humility and just having open ears and a closed mouth and just, you know, listening to what the coach has to say or what someone has to say and then just trying it, applying. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work, you know, but you never get in trouble for trying.
Speaking about humbling, Kyle Dake, who wrestles at 174 pounds, said last year he sparred with you for the first time and immediately regretted the decision. What did you do to him?
I don't know. I don't quite recall. Probably pulled on his head quite a bit. I don't remember.
Yeah.
There's been a few times between now and then, I'm sure, that we've sparred. I mean, so it all kind of runs together.
Have you gotten to know him pretty well?
I have. Yep. Yep. He's a good guy. He's interesting guy to learn from. He's got a lot of knowledge. You know, he's, always studying about the body and stuff like that. You know, I was kind of, well, not leery about him, but I was always kind of wondered about him because I never got to know him much before, you know, this past year or so. And every time we'd be at the training center, he's always, you know, running around with his shirt off and shorts on. I was like, what the heck is this guy doing? You know, but come to find out, he's all about getting that vitamin D from the sun and stuff like that. So he's interesting. I like what he has to say.
You got a couple of University of Nebraska guys on the team with James Greed and Jordan Burroughs. Are they trying to get you back over to be a Nebraskan?
No, I think they know better than that. No, they're good guys. Burroughs always gives me a hard time. When I was in high school at Scott, I'd come down and wrestle at Nebraska. And he said, yeah, I always knew you were going to Iowa. I was like, well, I did too, but I still need those good workouts, you know. So it's funny. He teases me a little bit.
Speaking of that, like the recruiting process, and it's interesting to me because, you know, the Hawkeyes are on fire right now with recruiting. And seems like maybe like their approach has changed a little bit compared to the days when I remember your recruitment vividly where they were letting you prepare for Cadet Worlds. And I think you were maybe a little bit confused by that too, why they weren't talking to you, as I replay it in my mind. But from your vantage point, what has changed with Iowa recruiting as far as you know?
I really don't know what's changed. I'm not really too involved with the, you know, the philosophy of the recruiting, but it's obviously changed. It's changing all the time. I think as time moves forward, you got to make changes and adapt. You know, it's not a bad thing. I mean, adapting is always a good thing, right? So I think we're just, you know, adapting and kind of seeing the landscape of how these other schools are recruiting and just kind of, you know, making adjustments, which is what you do in the sport, is you continually make adjustments. But yeah, but when I was getting recruited, I was getting ready for the Cadet World. So like Tommy, he left me alone, like you said. And in hindsight, that's the best thing he could have done. That's the best coach, you know, just letting me prepare, not worrying me with this drama of getting recruited. Because it is drama, you know, getting recruited. So a lot of pageantry and stuff. So looking back, it was the best thing for me. And in the end, it worked out good.
You know, through this process, you know, what I'm talking about with the recruiting here, they've brought in a couple new 133 pounders, Austin DeSanto, mm-hmm. Jason Renneria. What have those guys brought to the table in the practice room? And as far as, you know, your preparation for the World Championships, how have they helped you?
Man, well, DeSanto brings a lot to the table. He makes me laugh just even thinking about him. He's a freaking intense kid. He's really intense. He really wants to get better. And that's another kid that is pretty humble and is willing to learn and does learn every single day. I mean, just his pace and his tenacity, you know, he's got some areas he needs to work on, but he never gives up. You know, he's always in your face. I remember the first time I wrestled him here, you know, he got a takedown on me and I was coming out, you know, folk style escape and he foot sweat and kicked my foot up, you know, kind of being kind of stuff like I do. You know, I got mad for a split second. I got kind of mad. I was like, what is this guy doing? You know, he's just skating here. But I was like, I've been waiting 6 years for someone to do that to me in this room. So it fired me up. And I was like, this is the guy we need right here. Well, a little more mentality. But, you know, going on Jason Renteria, he trained with him a little bit. He's good in the underhooks, good in the upper body. So getting a guy like that is good for this international feel. You know, guys, you know, coming up a body, trying to throw you, you know, push you out of bounds, dealing with those underhooks. So they've both been been crucial to this journey.
When you're in the wrestling room, you have a lot of these college athletes, and as Andy alluded to, you are no longer in college. Do you feel like you have to have a different type of relationship with college athletes now that you're a professional?
Yes and no. I mean, I definitely have taken on more of a mentor type role, not so much as a coaching role, but just mentor role. You know, I'm in the trenches with these guys every day, so I think I can give them just a little different perspective than a coach, maybe. And that's not saying I know anything more than our coaches, but sometimes, you know, I can feel things different. Like wrestling DeSanto the other day, you know, I'm feeling things that areas he needs to work on. So I'm just like pulling him aside and kind of help. Hey, you know, pay attention to this area. You know, here's something that might be able to help you. You know, so just kind of taking a mentor role, not only in the wrestling, but in their, you know, everyday lives as well. Just kind of showing them, you know, kind of shepherding them in the right direction.
Thomas, you've gotten a chance this year to wrestle a lot of the top challengers at your weight class. What are the most valuable lessons you've learned from World Cup, Pan Ams? You know, going through the process of making the team again, Yasar Dagu, et cetera.
I just need to start early, keep my feet and hands moving, and just go out there and do what I do best, and just win, but win dominantly. I mean, I learned a lot from especially the World Cup and the Pan Ams. You know, not taking moral victories by any means, but you know, there's some adversity in that time of the year, and I'm still, you know, getting my shots off, getting two positions where I can score. And now that I'm getting ready to peak, and I'm peaking, and I feel the best I've ever felt in my life, I know that I can just close that door and not only beat these guys, but really dominate them.
Going back to your outlets, I've heard that you'll visit sick kids at the local hospital there in Iowa City. How did you start doing that?
That's kind of a good thing that the whole university does as an athletic program, you know, from the football program to the men's and women's basketball to the wrestling program here. You know, with the close proximity with the hospital, and especially the children's hospital, you know, they're always you know, kind of inviting us over to come see kids. You know, some kids are avid football fans or wrestling fans, or, you know, Spencer Lee, their favorite wrestler. So maybe a nurse or somebody will catch wind of that, and they'll give somebody a call over here, probably Julie, the secretary, and just kind of put a bug in Spencer Lee's ear and say, hey, you know, this kid, the big fan, how about you, you know, if you want to, you know, obviously, if you want to go over there and say hi, you know, take my poster. And you know what? About 9 times out of 10, those guys are doing it. Not only in our program, but football, basketball, gymnastics, anybody. So that's something that we, as a university, are really good about, I think.
And it's something you still do?
Yeah, of course. Of course.
Now,
go ahead.
Yeah, as you prepare for the World Championships, as we close out this interview, where are you in your training right now? Are you heading overseas fairly soon? What's the landscape look like for you?
Yeah, so on Monday, I go to Germany. I go to Ramstein Air Force Base in Germany, and we have our acclimation camp there for about a week and a half, and then from there we go to Budapest and get ready to rock.
Hey, we really appreciate this time. We're pulling for you. This is going to be a fun 2018 World Championships, and we're looking forward to seeing 10 gold medals.
Yeah, me too. It's going to be a good time.
All right, Thomas Gilman, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Really enjoyed that interview with Thomas Gilman. Some moments that maybe weren't audible into the microphone, but really made me laugh. First being the Kyle Dake and the short shorts, and just you saw his sense of humor, and that was fun to have that come out with the Thomas Gilman interview.
I'm not surprised that Gilman found himself intrigued by Dake. I think that their minds, while they might not be on the same wavelength totally, with the way that they approach training, I think Gilman probably respects how deep Dake's mind works for his obsession with functional patterns and his training with, because Kyle Dake's training looks a lot different than all the other guys on the men's freestyle world team from being around him and what he believes in and what gets him ready for competition. And he feels stronger and better than he ever has. He told me out at Camp Pendleton. It's pretty fascinating. That was one of the most fascinating things for me about being out at Camp Pendleton was watching Kyle Dake work on a day-to-day basis and what it looks like. And he's got his own personal functional patterns coach out there. I could see where Gilman would be pretty intrigued by Kyle Dake.
What do you think is Thomas Gilman's training pattern? Because I don't know that he's necessarily what you think of with the complete Iowa style. I think he has his own uniqueness to him. And I think that came through in the interview, that he has a way that is going to get him to that level. And clearly it's worked last year. It worked this year. What do you think that is that gets him mentally ready to get to the next level?
Well, I think that one thing that was really fascinating to me, and it has been fascinating to me for a long time about Thomas Gilman, is this element of coachability surrounding him. And Mark Perry has talked to me about it for a year plus now. And that was one of the first things that impressed him when he got back to Iowa City and started working with Gilman, was just how coachable he was. And you listen, in the interview, he talks about learning from Spencer Lee. He talks about learning from his opponents, as well as coaches within his room. So he's soaking up all the information that he can get from so many different sources around the world and then processing it and figuring out what works for him. But just the fact that he spends so much time trying to learn from his opponents, not just what they're doing in their matches against him, but also maybe some of the things that's working for them against other opponents. And I was pretty intrigued by that.
I wouldn't want to draw Thomas Gilman if I'm at the World Championships on my side of the bracket. I just think that's a tough out.
It's a two-pronged deal too. I mean, you know that if you have what it takes to beat him, he's going to put you through the ringer, and you're not going to have as much left in the tank in that next round. And you know that's not necessarily good for Gilman if he doesn't get his hand raised either, because he's dependent on those guys to pull him back in. How many times did we see it with Brent Metcalf at World Championship events where he would put opponents through hell and then they've got nothing left. Yeah. And then he's, you know, if they find a way to beat him, then he's cooked too. So, but you know, with Gilman, he's going to bring a fight and he's going to be really stingy on his feet. He's going to probably get to your legs and he's going to be hard to turn.
Our final guest of this edition of On the Mat, Sarah Hildebrandt, will represent the United States at 116 pounds, or for Andy, 53 kilograms. You seem to like Budapest. You wrestled there for the World Championships in 2016, now 2018. What can you tell us about this great city and great country?
It is so fun, but yeah, I was chuckling that. You know, it's the same place that I was in 2016, but it's a really beautiful city, and they really, you know, take good care of you. It's a great setup. It's a beautiful venue. I think we'll be in a different gym, but very similar. Hotels are nearby, so it'll be really fun. I'm looking forward to it. It's been nice for my visualization process because I've literally been there, so...
Sarah, settle something for us. And Kyle is kind of baiting you with how he pronounced it. But how do you pronounce Budapest? Or do you pronounce it Budapest?
I say Budapest.
Thank you.
That's the way that sounds right. But I just checked on pronunciation. And Andy is this stickler on grammar. And he's so good at writing. And his writing so clean. I would think he'd want to say it grammatically correct. Or at least pronounce it right. But he doesn't want to. It's all right, Andy. Now, talking about countries and where you're from Indiana, great basketball country. Is it as fanatical a basketball country as Iowa would be for wrestling?
Yeah, I feel like I also am from South Bend, Indiana. So it's Notre Dame football is really what I grew up with, the crazy fans there. But yeah, we definitely have big basketball background as well. So, you know, there's always that, the like rivalry between the wrestlers and the basketball players. But it was definitely Notre Dame football that I remember growing up. That was just the whole town shut down. So
it is that fanatical that it's larger than life.
It's just that crazy.
Have you been to a game?
I'm like, why can't you guys be wrestling fans?
Do you go to games?
Yeah, I do. When I get the chance, I haven't been home very often. But yeah, I would go tailgate, go Notre Dame games all the time growing up, and it's fun. It's an experience. I think everyone should visit the campus at one point. It's really a special thing.
Watching your interviews are fun because you have an outgoing personality. Did you always have that in grade school, middle school, high school?
No. Actually, I didn't even speak. Like, I would not speak a word. I moved a bunch growing up when I was younger. So I went to a bunch of different elementary schools. Didn't speak, was very nervous. And then really wrestling has kind of brought me out of my shell so much and given me confidence and just puts me in a good mood too. So I can always be happy.
How so? Can you elaborate on that, Sarah, on what it did for you that changed your personality?
Yeah. I mean, just to be able to do something that many people told me I couldn't, or even at times that I believed that I wasn't even capable of. And, you know, to fight through that, maybe I didn't always win a wrestling match, but to fight through practices, to fight against people who told me I didn't deserve to be out there, and just to continue to come back and give my best, like, that instills a lot of belief in you. And I think it really did for me. And then on top of that, I was starting to find success in the sport. And you know, it's hard to avoid confidence at that point, and just, and how it made me feel so much very proud of who I was and very confident of who I was becoming. And it just was easy to apply that to all aspects of my life.
When you're around other female wrestlers, do you talk about your entry into the sport and what it was like and just some of those stories that you might have about overcoming some adversity as being in the women's wrestling game?
Yeah, definitely. It'll come up. You know, it's always fun to hear the other girls' stories, or to, you know, finally be able to relate to someone, because a lot of us grew up on men's teams. So, you know, it couldn't completely relate with everybody we were around, but then to be around the girls who grew up in the same environment, oh, was that coach mean to you? Or was this, you know, did you have to go through that too? Or, and to be able to talk about that. And yeah, we talk about that a lot.
You're in a unique situation where you could have women's coaches and men's coaches. How does that differ in, as far as how a woman would give you advice versus how a man would give you advice?
You know, it's just nice to be able to relate directly to a woman. As far as wrestling advice, you know, it can be pretty straightforward. I just want to hear what it is, you know, not necessarily who it's coming from. But, you know, also, like, if I'm thinking about, like, when Terry's telling me something versus Clarissa, like, Clarissa probably wrestles a lot more similar to how I do in terms of flexibility and strength and, you know, just the realisticness of whatever we're learning is probably just a little more realistic on her end. But, and, you know, that's the same with, like, weight cutting or, you know, it's, our bodies are different, and she, well, Clarissa didn't cut weight, but some girls, you know, they definitely have a more relatable experience.
In the article Andy wrote about you recently, one of the things that I really admired and thought was really unique was that you really made a transformation in how you viewed diet. And I think a lot of people think about the training and just the obsessiveness that you have as a wrestler, but you really changed your diet. What went into really focusing in on your diet and how that made a difference?
Yeah, definitely these weigh-in procedures. You know, I find out that they're changing the weigh-in procedures. And to me, it was like, wow, am I really going to let this silly rule change, you know, hold me back from achieving, you know, what I want to set out to do? That would just be such a silly reason to, you know, sit back and look out and be like, oh, I didn't win the Olympics because I just couldn't stay disciplined in my diet. Like, my wrestling was there, everything was there, but I was so tired from cutting weight. Like, that just drove me up a wall. And, you know, to be weighing in 2 hours before competition, it definitely had to be a different plan of attack. So that was really what motivated me to get that going. And I, once I had my first, like, really clean, easy weight cut, I was hooked. I was like, oh my gosh, I'm never putting on a sweatshirt again.
Yeah.
So it was good.
How do you stay locked into an efficient diet that will work for you? Because it is a little bit difficult with our world with fast food and how we perceive food. How do you stay focused on eating healthy?
You know, it's definitely nice that I have accessibility to the training center. I still have my meal plan there, so I can go and, you know, I don't have to spend a ton of money, or I don't have to spend any money. I can just get the food there, and it's, you know, there's healthy options available to me. On top of that, I do give myself some little breaks, like, I don't know, order cookies from somewhere extravagant. And so it's not just a constant go, go, go. But with that said, also staying, eating clean is like, the longer you go, I feel like the easier it gets. The more treats you throw in, it's so addicting. Sugar is addicting. And so, you know, I find myself, it's a lot easier when I'm 2 months into a very clean diet versus like just starting out.
If I remember, you liked the Final X process. What did you like about it?
Oh my God, it was so fun. I think about that just all the time. It was just such a great experience. I love the hype, you know, the hoopla of all fun, the press conference. I love that we knew our opponents going in, so there could, you know, we could build this story around the two competitors. And then it was just exciting for wrestlers and fans alike. So I'm already excited for next year. It was really fun with the lights, the walkout music. You know, it could be a really like personalized experience, like towards one wrestler. So you could really build like a fan base or something. And that's cool. I think it's something our sport needs.
And it has to be fun to be part of this, that women's wrestling really is getting its due and just a lot of great momentum right now for women's wrestling. It has to be fun for you to be part of this time period, knowing that you're part of something special.
Oh my gosh. So true. Yeah, exactly right. Like Final X also was just a chance for the women to really show just, you know, how talented we are. And if I look back at those matches, all of the women's matches were incredible. It was so fun to watch. And I really hope that other people thought that. But also the way you said, yeah, it's also so great to be a part of, you know, kind of paving the way for future generations. And I'm grateful for the people before me that allowed me to compete on such a stage. So it is really cool. It's something that motivates you in the morning.
There will be a special wrestle-off between Helen Maroulis and Alex Hedrick. Do you follow that? Do you keep tabs on what's happening there with that special wrestle-off before the World Championships?
Yeah, I'll definitely be following. I mean, you know, this is somebody who's going to be coming into our team and for our world team, and, you know, that's exciting, and I'm looking forward to it. I'm sure the girls are excited to finally get their wrestle-off. You know, a week before we leave. So it'll be nice to have a complete team afterwards and, you know, to see how hard those girls have been training.
Sarah, if you go back to March in the World Cup, 1 point loss to Haruna Okuna, the reigning world champion. She's gone down to 50 kilos, but 7-6 match. Couple matches in Poland where you placed fifth were really close bouts as well. What have you taken from them that will help you moving into Budapest?
Yeah. You know, that match with Okuna was really, that was a great confidence booster. You know, she's very decorated and it kind of just, I think I've gotten so much better since then. So it's, you know, that helps with confidence. And then also, you know, those matches in Poland, the scoreboard did not reflect what I wanted to, but there was a lot of great things that I did in those matches, also against some very good wrestlers. Actually, the girl I lost to in the beginning, that Japanese girl, she had teched me just earlier in the year. And so to have closed the gap so much, but I think it was like 4-2 or 4-3 or something like that, you know, just showing I'm making improvements. And I think at Poland, there are just little fixes I needed to make, and I have made them. So going into Budapest, I'm so glad I've had so much experience versus everyone in my weight class, because I'm prepared for anything and everything.
International travel, when you do that and you go overseas, it's different than wrestling domestically, where you have a fan base and quite a few people in your corner. What do you have to do to get yourself ready to compete internationally?
More so it's about staying calm, I think. And my parents will actually be in Budapest. They're wonderful. So that'll be great that we'll have a few voices in the stands cheering for us. But yeah, definitely I think staying overseas or being overseas and competing, and especially at this tournament in particular, is about staying calm and not necessarily getting too excited or too up. I think that's something I struggled with in 2016 and something I've gotten a lot better at now. Just knowing I have a great support system and I've done the work and staying calm with that.
You attended King College. What was your major?
Business. Woot.
Yeah. What's that going to translate into? Marketing major.
What's that?
What's that going to translate into eventually? You going to be a business person, walk the streets of New York?
No, not at all. No, my dad's probably melting in his chair if he hears it. No, I actually would like to be a writer. I love writing. I like writing fantasy. But I got a business major because I felt like it was applicable to many realms of life. But here I am wanting to become an author. So.
Tell us about some of the writing. Have you written anything? Is it just for personal use? Anything that you would show us at some point?
Maybe way in the future when I can hide under a rock. No, I do write. I write a lot for fun. I also write just journals, keeping track of, you know, what I'm doing every day and how I'm feeling. And, you know, I've done that since I was probably in third grade. So looking back on that stuff now is, it's hilarious. I'm so glad I did it. It's also cringy all at the same time. But, you know, I think it'll be fun when I'm way old and gray and can read back on all these awesome experiences so vividly.
I think there's a great opportunity here with you. Andy happens to work for trackwrestling.com. I think there's a great outlet here if you and Andy got hooked up and just tried to get some authorship on the website. What do you think, Andy?
I like the way you're thinking, Kyle, because that was running through my head when you were saying that.
So
you got an offer, Sarah. You got an offer if you want to write a first-person account for track wrestling of what you're going through in your training or preparation for the World Championships or after the World Championships. The invitation is open.
All right. That does sound awesome. I think that would be cool. That would be fun.
Because if your writing is anything as good as your interviews, then you've got an A going right now. Yeah, I think it could be a good outlet. Now, looking forward to what you have with wrestling. Of course, you're in the midst of an Olympic cycle, and you talk about what you want to do at some point. Is wrestling the end game? Is this something you want to stay with for long term?
Many people are surprised to hear that. No, I love wrestling and love giving myself to wrestling and all I have. But I love that, you know, being a professional athlete has presented me a really unique opportunity to completely start over in life when I'm done. And a lot of times people don't get to do that, without some sort of penalty, like maybe they're fired or something traumatic happens in their life. But, I'm, you know, as an athlete, I get a really lucky chance that I just kind of get a fresh start at something new. And there's a part of me that really looks forward to that. And of course, I always be in love with wrestling and give back to wrestling, you know, once my time comes to an end with the sport. But, you know, I really am excited to see what other adventures I can take and master and explore. So that's a very exciting prospect to me.
You were telling us that you live right between Manitou Springs and Colorado Springs in Colorado, of course. What do you like to do? You have the Cog Trail right there. You have a lot of great outdoor outlets. What do you do when you're not wrestling?
I do the incline, the Cog Trail, every week. It is my favorite challenge. But what do I like to do? I love reading. I love playing ukulele. So I'm actually kind of a homebody. I have all these beautiful things around me. They provide inspiration to look at from my window. But no, I do try to get out if I can. Like I said, do the incline. Occasionally we'll hit a good hike, but definitely love to stay inside and, you know, read, write, play ukulele.
Kyle, Sarah was telling me out at Women's Freestyle Training Camp that she's a new homeowner. She just got a cat. And I see on Instagram you've got a cat wheel for your cat. Can you tell us a little bit about your cat on the cat wheel?
Okay, yes. I bought this ginormous cat wheel that my boyfriend was like, oh my gosh, at. And, you know, he's training too, just like me, this cat. So it's so funny. He'll get on this wheel and just full out sprint. It'll be like 2:30 in the morning. And I'm just like, dang, maybe I should go on a run right now too. Like, you're inspiring me right now. Yeah, he gets after it on the cat wheel. It's inspiring and hilarious and adorable all at once.
And you, I think I saw that too, where you actually had the cat sit and take instructions. I've never seen a cat do that before.
Yeah, we've been working. My boyfriend particularly has been working so hard and like training him at those tricks. Yeah, so he can sit. He knows his name, like come here. He knows high five. And right now we're working on laying down and coming along. Coming along.
That's great. Now, going back to the Cog Trail, that is very famous in Colorado Springs, Manitou Springs, and a lot of the wrestlers do that too. We've seen video and stories about that. I think they've redone it recently, haven't they? Isn't it pretty nice now? It's not the old railroad ties they had there?
Yeah, it's much safer. And yeah, it looks like, you know, it was made for that, for what we're using it for now. So it's fun and safe. I'm not worried about rolling my ankle every time now.
What's the traffic out there? A lot of people still do it, just general pedestrians?
Yeah, there's definitely people that I see every time I'm up there. But it's, you know, now that it's coming into the fall months, it'll start, it's not tourist season anymore, which is nice. So it'll just be a few locals. It won't be too bad now and going into winter. But in the summertime, oh my goodness, there are so many people. And, you know, like I'm there to train, so I have like my training mindset. But those people are there to take pictures and, you know, lollygag up, and which is fine. But I'm like, get out of my way. I'm trying to break my time. So it's battling the tourists at that point.
Well, I'll tell you what, why don't you get an Instagram video of you doing the Cog Trail with your cat?
Oh my gosh. You know, I think he would love it because he's leash trained as well.
Yeah.
He's great on a leash. So yeah, if this will keep him from running at 2 a.m, that sounds like a good idea.
Hey, we're excited about the opportunity you have at the World Championships. I really appreciate you taking the time to be on our program. Been fun getting to know you, and we'll look forward to seeing you in Hungary. So we'll go the middle route, not use the actual town name. We'll use the country name as a middle ground here. So
compromise.
So all the best. Thanks for joining us on this edition.
Yes, thank you so much. See you in Hungary.
All right, that was Sarah Hildebrandt. For Andy Hamilton, I'm Kyle Klingman. You have been listening on the Mat.
This show is part of the Matt Talk Podcast Network.
For more wrestling podcasts, head over to MattTalkOnline.com.